Members of the National Academy of Public Administration share an important characteristic. Even if you retire from your job, you never really give up public service. That's one reason NAPA fellows are always eager to help out agencies in trouble or offer help during presidential transitions. For more than 5 years, NAPA's affairs have been guided by CEO Dan G. Blair. He'll be stepping down this month, and he joins me now for a retrospective. Dan, good to have you back.
It's good. It's good to hear from you, Tom. I appreciate that.
So
thank
5 years.
Thank you for having me on this morning. You'd mentioned a retirement. I think this is going to be more of a pause for me, maybe a few days or a few weeks, because I'm going to be heading off into some future endeavors, and I have a couple of irons in the fire at this point. But right now, my focus is on making sure that we have that we continue to be successful through the end of this calendar year.
Now, let's back up before we look ahead. You spent a long time in public service, about 27 years or so, actually more than that, nearly 30 years. And in the executive branch and on Capitol Hill, review briefly what it is that you did in those years.
Well, I came to Washington, D.C. After I graduated from law school, and I worked for my local congressman. And he was the ranking Republican on a committee that was called at that time the Post Office and Civil Service Committee that had jurisdiction over postal issues and civil service issues. And one of the first tasks that I was thrown into was helping design a new, what was then called a new retirement system for feds that were hired after January 1st, 1984. That system was the Federal Employee Retirement System, and that was my first taste of legislative action when I came to Washington.
So you were instrumental in the CSRS to FERS.
I was. I was the minority counsel on the committee. And it was actually the Republicans who helped break a deadlock by coming up with some cost-saving measures that the administration, that Republicans and Democrats in Congress, and even the unions and employee groups alike could live with.
And then you went and kind of lived with the consequences of what you did regarding personnel 10 years at OPM.
Exactly. You know, I was telling a colleague of mine, it's all from where you sit. Because while I was at OPM, we were the subject of a couple of GAO studies that I had actually been part of the initial request. So it's interesting to see it from different sides of the table. But that was a phenomenal experience at the Office of Personnel Management as a deputy director and acting director. That was a time of some really broad personnel reforms and attempts at reforms during the Bush administration. It was a very exciting time for the agency. And from there, I was named chairman of a new organization. It was the successor organization to what was called the Postal Rate Commission. And the new organization was the Postal Regulatory Commission. And that was a product of a 2006 postal reform bill that I had had a hand in when I was the staff director for then-Chair John McHugh on the House side, who started the postal reform movement in 1996. So, again, what goes around comes around, and I was able to help implement a piece of legislation that I had worked early on.
And just as an aside, the Postal Service has the Postal Regulatory Commission, and it has the Postal Board of Governors. Is that kind of a lot of oversight?
Well, for the Postal Service, it is oversight, but it's also oversight that Congress wanted. That before the Postal Reorganization Act of, I think it was 1970, that the Postal Service was in the Post Office Department. It had the Postmaster General was appointed by the President, was a member of the Cabinet, and when they reinstituted the reforms in 1970. Congress wanted to remove it from the political realm, but Congress needed assistance on the day-to-day oversight of the agency because it's so large and it touches Americans every day. It's one of the few agencies that actually does that. And
sure.
So it surrogates. You have an IG, you have a Board of Governors, which is the governing body for the Postal Service, but Congress also wanted to have some checks and balances on the rates the Postal Service charged. And that was the impetus for the Independent Postal Rate Commission at the time.
Well, let's talk about NAPA for a minute. Not everyone actually that are NAPA fellows is necessarily retired, so it's current serving feds plus a lot of retirees.
You are absolutely right. We just brought in a class of 50 people, and many of them are current feds. Many of them are current academics. We have representatives as fellows from, every major school of public affairs and administration within the fellowship. We also have state and local officials as well. So it's a good mix between people who are active in their career, at the top of their career, and people who've retired.
We are speaking with Dan G. Blair, the soon to move on CEO.
Soon to transition to other opportunities.
Right, of the National Academy of Public Administration. What's your view of the role NAPA play? Where does it fit in the pantheon of all the influences on government around Washington?
Well, I would argue that the Academy is an oversight mechanism for the Congress. We are one of two congressionally chartered research organizations, the other one being the National Academies of Sciences. And Congress chartered us because they wanted an independent, objective body to advise it on issues of public administration. And so while we are not IGs, we don't do IG work, we certainly aren't GAO, although we have a number of fellows who come from GAO, we are oftentimes tasked by Congress or asked by agencies to assist them in governance and public administration issues.
And you recently have come out with two really big reports, comprehensive reports. I think the latest one is the U.S. Secret Service, and before that, Veterans Affairs. So these are not trivial issues that you take on.
No, not at all. And these are very important issues. We're very proud of our work that we did in partnership with the U.S. Secret Service. They asked us to come in and do a review. We did a comprehensive four-month review in looking at their operations and how the progress that they're making on all the various recommendations that they have been the subject of in order to improve their operations. And then we recently released our work regarding the disability backlog with the Veterans Benefits Administration. And that was a congressionally mandated piece of work. And we looked at ways of improving the structure and improving how they handle these disability claims in order to prevent future backlogs from arising. And we also looked at other issues, including their appeals backlogs as well. When we do these studies, we employ a very interesting way of looking at these. It's the Academy, but we also appoint an expert panel of fellows to do the work. And so the work is actually issued by the panel. Each panel is anywhere from 3 to 7 members, and then it'll be staffed by an expert study team. And so the panel and the study team working together, the panel drives and directs the programs. The study team does the legwork, and they produce these work products, which are then submitted to Congress and or the agencies, depending on who the requester was.
Now, there's a new administration coming in, and they have some things to say about public service and civil servants, two, I guess, slightly different things, but they're very closely aligned. And there have been attempts, as you've described, to change and maybe in some cases revolutionize civil service over the years. And yet the civil service is a big organization. It tends to absorb a lot of what's thrown at it without changing that much. What's your view of the balance of how you move an organization or move a civil service correctly and definitively without wrecking what it is that makes it unique?
Well, I can only offer my personal experience and advice on this, but my view of comprehensive large government reforms to be effective requires so-called skin in the game from both sides. If these reforms that are viewed as an initiative of one party or one president without bipartisan support of the other side, even if it's small, these kinds of reforms are I don't want to say doomed, but they are certainly going to face rigorous scrutiny in the next administration. The ACA is a prime example of that. I don't think that, as I recall, the ACA passed with no Republican support.
That's correct.
And now you have a Republican Congress, you have a Republican president, and for the champions for that, there are no natural allies within the administration or within the majorities in Congress to improve or correct the issues confronting the ACA. We saw this with the National Security Personnel System, that when President Obama came in, the unions had always voiced their highest opposition to the NSPS reforms. And without a champion within the administration or even a champion on the Democratic side, we saw that system, which was actually beginning to work, demise because of politics. And so what I would, my simple advice to the next administration is that when you undertake these reforms, at the end of the day, they're going to need to have some bipartisan support if they're going to survive into the next administration.
So 30 some years in public service and now 5 years at the National Academy. What's your view on the value of civil service in the sense of, would you advise someone young now to come into it?
I would, without reservation. We hear the difficult stories of the hiring process. We also know that pay is not not always competitive depending on the job with the private sector. We hear about the red tape. We hear about the frustrations. But at the same time, if you have a dedication to public service, this is where it's at. And if you want to make a difference in terms of your country, in terms of your government, this is an opportunity that you have. You're going to have struggles. You're going to bump up against systems that will be frustrating. But you know what? You do that in the private sector as well. People think that it's very difficult to fire a federal employee. Federal employees have due process rights. But you know what? It's also difficult in the private sector. If you want to fire an employee in D.C., you have to go through multiple hoops. And so there is a difference between public and private employment. But if you want to make a difference in the public space, I would argue the best place to do it is by being a public servant.
The senior executive service has been subject of some scrutiny in the last couple of years. It took President Obama, a number of years before he met, it was during his second term that he met with members of the senior executive service. What's your view of what should happen there to keep that vibrant and compelling?
Well, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I do see the momentum in Congress, and I certainly read that about the new administration coming in regarding due process rights for senior executives and wanting to diminish those rights. I think that there's a balance. Some felt that balance was out of whack, that when people who, for instance, with the General Services Administration, those executives involved in those conferences that were well publicized were protected by the current system to an extent that they appealed successfully to the Merit Systems Protection Board. I think that outraged a number of members of Congress and the public to see what they may have perceived as quote unquote gaming the system. So I do see a movement in Congress, and I do see an administration that will be open to ideas of making, especially the senior executives, enhancing accountability and restricting the ability to utilize the system to defend their actions.
And on the other end of the whole spectrum, the initial hiring process you mentioned a few minutes ago, that seems to be almost impervious to real reform.
Well, let me do some myth busting on this. At the Academy over the past few years, we have been working with the Centers for Disease Control. And we were brought in by CDC to look at their hiring process. They were finding it extremely cumbersome. They were not getting the candidates that they wanted. And I would suggest that hiring reforms can take place within departments or agencies if a few things take place. Number one, it has to be a management priority. It has to be a leadership priority. Two, the HR office and the hiring office, the program office, need to communicate. Far too often, those two offices do not communicate, that the program office, who needs to have the don't effectively communicate their needs to the HR office. In turn, the HR office may perform the same types of actions as been performing for a number of years and not realizing that the vacancy announcements, the position descriptions, etc., do not meet the needs of the hiring entity. You get the conversations going between those two, you can dramatically affect the quality of hires and also the time of hires. We have the workup on our website and we talk about this, and we have had great success with the Centers for Disease Control. I think a lot of this can be extrapolated government-wide, but it takes time and effort and rolling up your sleeves, but moreover, it's communication between the HR office and the hiring office in order to make these changes possible.
And given everything that's happened in the country over the past, say, 3-4 years, past year maybe, are you optimistic as you step away from the NAPA?
I'm an optimistic person. I think that our government systems lag behind when it comes to the necessary changes that have to take place. We're still living under a general schedule system that represents the best thinking of the mid-20th century. Even our Civil Service Reform Act, which is highly touted, was done in 1978. So I think that we need to take a strong look at our systems of how we manage our employees, how we bring them in, how we pay them, how we classify them, and bring it into the 21st century. Doing that, however, can be a very difficult task. And I think that the Trump administration is going to have to confront that, because I think that if you look back at every major program failure, you can point to the people. And if you don't have the right people with the right skills doing the right jobs, you're going to continue to have that. And the public's not going to stand for that. So I think updating and modernizing the civil service will be among the highest priorities for the Trump administration.